afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Clayton Boyce, and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor of Nightrider Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are listening to this program on National Public Radio or watching on C-SPAN. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On April 28th, Herschel Shanks, editor of the Biblical Archaeology Review, will discuss the Dead Sea Scrolls. On April 29th, the Dalai Lama will address the club on U.S.-China relations. On April 30th, Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole will discuss President Clinton's first 100 days in office. And on May 4th, Christopher Patton, Governor of Hong Kong, will discuss economic and political developments in Hong Kong. I'd like to remind you that audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. Secretary Bruce Babbitt has only been in town for a little while, and he's finding things don't always run smoothly. Although Mr. Babbitt was on hand when his wife Hattie was sworn in as ambassador to the Organization of American States, nobody remembered to invite her to his swearing-in, which led him to speculate to the crowd at the swearing-in, gee, I wonder if we had a fight today. And now that I look around, where is Mrs. Babbitt today? The secretary is from Arizona, where much of the storefront signage carries the Babbitt name. The Babbitts have been entrenched in the Flagstaff area since 1886, when the secretary's grandfather and brother started, started a mercantile and ranching empire. Now there's a Babbitt car dealership, a hardware store, a Babbitt mortuary. Now there's an idea. Where do administration ideas go to die anyways? I would say the U.S. Senate right now. Mr. Babbitt is remembered for the superhuman lengths he went to get elected president in 1988. He biked with his family across Iowa. He climbed a mountain in New Hampshire and organized a hiking and boating trip through the Grand Canyon. He had fun, but voters weren't impressed. Weren't impressed enough, anyways. Actually, standing up for taxes made Babbitt history, as that combination of biker, climber, and taxer caused his campaign to fizzle. A Harvard-educated lawyer, Mr. Babbitt was governor from 1978 to 1987, first taking office at age 39 upon the death of Governor Wesley Bolin. Although it was an unexpected turn of events, Mr. Babbitt got into the swing early. He vetoed three bills in his first 4 months. He was Attorney General of his state before that, and like the president he serves, he went to graduate school in England, although in his case it was the University of Newcastle. Although he was a Democrat in a Republican state, many people in both parties say he's the most popular governor in Arizona's history. He effected reforms in health care, education, and environmental protection. He enacted programs of water management and child welfare, and got friendly with the governor of Arkansas, one Bill Clinton. The use of the term policy wonk has not been limited to Bill Clinton. Mr. Babbitt is known to have an impressive grasp of public policy. Most recently, he was the president of the League of Conservation Voters, an environmental group that fights the advocates of Western ranching, mining, and energy interests. Now he is the overseer of 500 million acres of forest, parks, wildlife refuge, and other public lands. He must decide the best balance on protecting the environment and using the land in his charge. He has said that we have to learn to live more lightly on the land. Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce Babbitt.
Clay, thank you. I must say, of All the introductions I've had, that's the most recent. I must say, however, that it is good to be invited back to the press club at long last. It's been, I think, 5 years since I was last over here. And I must tell you, nothing much has changed except the food is really measurably better, for which I congratulate you. The Babbitts, I must tell all of you, are having a great time in the Clinton administration. My wife, Hattie, as the new ambassador to the Organization of American States, is having an extraordinary experience. My teenage kids have, after a rather rainy and dismal physical and psychological winter, have now decided that with the advent of spring that this is indeed a good town, even for teenagers. And for my part, I must tell you, I really do enjoy this job. It's really an extraordinary opportunity. I walk into my office every morning, and the hall is lined with portraits of my predecessors from 1843 to the present. It's not the most distinguished company in which to start a day. I walk in the door, and there on the wall is Albert Fall, gone to jail for taking bribes, selling leases in the Teapot Dome scandal. I walk further down the hall, and there's Jim Watt. I wonder, where are his spiritual descendants in this department? But of course, that's an oxymoron. And I took a look one day at all of my predecessors. There were four of them in the 1980s. Three of them did not complete their term of office. And I look across all this, and I've concluded as follows. In order to be in the top third of my class at this department in the sweep of American history, I must do two things. First, stay out of jail. And secondly, complete a four-year term. With that, I'd like to reflect a little bit on the conduct of my office during the past 100 days and how it is that what I'm doing relates to the president's agenda, particularly in this area which has come to such recent prominence, the administration of the natural resource base out west under the control and administration of this department. Now, several weeks ago, President Clinton laid out in his budget a new approach to the use of these natural resources. And the concept embodied in his budget is at once simple and quite profound. It says simply that the time is at hand to begin to put market principles into the sale and disposition of public resources. Now, the budget rationale for moving to the market is, I think, pretty obvious and straightforward. First, we must raise revenues to meet the budget targets that are now before the Congress. Second is the simple issue of fairness. It's absolutely unreasonable to say to the American people, everyone should pay their fair share, except miners, except timber companies, except ranchers and reclamation water users. Now, apart from these economic reasons, the move to market, I think, also has important environmental benefits, because market pricing of resources encourages conservation. And it dictates that those limited resources will be used wisely and allocated correctly in markets. What I'd like to do today in my time is to discuss the implementation of this move to market, if you will, for just three of the resources administered by the Department of the Interior: hard rock minerals, forage, and water. Public land reform has at last become a genuine public issue, and the American people are entitled to know in detail where we stand and how it is that we propose to put these reform proposals in place. Of one thing I think you can be certain, and that is that 1993 will be the year of reform for public land and water. President Clinton has said as much, and he's right. The administration is solidly committed to land use reform. And the question is not if these changes will occur, but how they occur. We respect the fact that there are, after all these many years, deeply held opinions and substantial differences. And we'll do everything we can to consult with, talk with, listen to all of those differing points of view. But 1993 must be the year of decision. The first legislative test will be the reform of the mining law of 1872. Hard rock mining is the one area of federal resource law where the unrestrained, giveaway, environment be damned attitudes of the 19th century have persisted uninterrupted across the 19th century and all the way to the end of the 20th century. Now, 121 years may seem like a bit of a rush for some of our friends in Congress, but I'd submit to you that the time is long overdue to reform a law that was passed, think of it this way, it was passed 4 years before the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Now, I don't mean to imply anything by using that battle as a reference point, but whatever your beliefs or opinions, the time is clearly at hand. Now, the reform agenda for hard rock mining is quite straightforward. First, the land patent system should be abolished. The patenting of land into private ownership for $2.50 an acre, $5 an acre, it's a plain old giveaway, and it doesn't have anything to do with mining needs, and it has way too much to do with a lot of unnecessary speculation. Second, miners should pay an annual claim holding fee. Each year, and I know this of my own experience out in Arizona where I've participated in some of this, I must confess to you, claims are filed solely for speculation, and in some cases with the hope that somehow by holding a claim in a critical area that's about ready to become a national monument, a national park, a recreation area, that you can extort some compensation from Uncle Sam when land use changes are made. Now, the idea is that a reasonable holding fee will separate the sheep from the goats, or if you will, the gold from the glitter. The serious miners will pay the fee. The speculators will be induced to go into more productive enterprises than trying to figure out ways to extort the taxpayer and the public treasury. Third, miners ought to be required to do their work according to a pre-approved plan. They should be required to post bonds for cleanup and reclamation. Imagine that. We're going to make them clean up after themselves. Fourth, lest we forget the obvious, mining companies must be required to pay royalties to the owners of the minerals. Done everywhere else in the world, it's an intrinsic part of the market system. The owner of the land normally doesn't give the minerals away for free. The owner of the land normally says this is property, it has value. Miners ought to pay royalties. The one exception, it seems, is a patsy called the public. That's you and me and all Americans. And it's time to say we expect that public land will be mined with the payment of royalties. Now, the opponents of mining reform have repeatedly opposed these reforms as impractical, unworkable, destructive of the industry. I would challenge them today to respond to some simple and, I believe, unimpeachable facts. First of all, the environmental reforms that we advocate have already been implemented in what I would call the soft rock mining sector, and that simply is the Surface Mining Act of 1976, which imposed mining plans, bonds, restoration, and reclamation standards on the American coal industry. Now, many of you will remember that prior to the passage of the Surface Mine Control Act, we heard the usual predictions of gloom and doom, despair and destruction. The fact is that despite all those predictions, the American coal industry has not disappeared. It has not moved offshore, and it's not gone broke. Quite to the contrary, the industry is more prosperous than ever. And there's one important difference. In the hollows of West Virginia and Kentucky, and out there on the plains of Wyoming, the residents who once lived beside ruined landscapes and drank from polluted streams are now living in a healthy, restored landscape. That's what we're asking of the hard rock mining industry. And it seems to me that it's inevitable that the American people will back up that request. I'd offer you another fact to those holdouts who say reform is unthinkable. We've already imposed royalties. Back in 1920, a law was passed which said that when you mine coal, oil, and gas, you don't get a patent, you get a lease, and you pay a royalty, ranging from approximately 12 to 16%. Now, the royalty system works for oil and gas and coal, and I have yet to hear why it is that it won't work for the hard rock mining industry, that is gold, copper, silver, and metals. Well, the refrain that I get is, you don't understand. Our situation is different. The usual refrain is, well, some ore bodies are very profitable, others are less profitable, and others are marginal, and that makes it different. Well, but that's also true of oil fields and gas fields and coal fields. I mean, a well in 2,000 feet of deep water off the Gulf of Mexico pays royalties. It's a lot more costly than drilling a well in the Permian Basin in West Texas, but they both pay royalties. No one's calling for a repeal of the federal royalty program for oil and gas and coal. Now, others contend, they say, well, hard rock minerals are different because the ore requires processing, beneficiation, as they say in the trade. It has to be milled before the final product reaches the market. Well, haven't they heard of petroleum refining? Now, I won't elaborate the specific compelling factual cases that we've talked about, but having said I won't, I will, at least a couple of them, because they're simply things that the public ought to hear. I am confronted now with a company called American Barrick Goldstrike, which is a foreign corporation, which is exercising its right to claim title to public lands in Nevada under the Mining Location Act that are estimated to contain $10 billion in gold. Now, under the mining law, I'm required to give American Barrick that land, no royalties, your land, for a paperwork fee of $5 an acre. That means for $10 billion in gold, they're paying you about $9,000. Another example that I must pass by is this issue of the speculative holding of claims for purposes which you can imagine. I have sitting in front of me an example in which 3 years ago an Oregon family paid less than $2,000 in fees to acquire the rights to mine, now listen to this, not some strategic mineral in the national interest, but sand. Sand in the midst of the Oregon National Recreation Area. Now, come on, who are we kidding? Why do you think that claim was staked? Because the mining operation is now threatening to despoil the National Recreation Area, the federal government is considering buying back the land. The price? $12 million. Is that extortion? Now, certainly there's room to discuss and compromise on these issues, but we can't compromise if we don't talk, and we can't talk unless both sides are willing to put something on the table and be reasonable. Now, maybe the 12.5% gross royalty that I'm suggesting is high. But I got to tell you, there are higher numbers out on the landscape today. For example, the Newmont Mining Company is currently paying a private landowner in Nevada an 18% royalty on a gold claim. Now, on the way in today, I met a Newmont Mining shareholder. She's right here in the audience. Her name is I'm going to blow her cover. Her name is Mary O'Keefe Gravelos. She walked up to me And she said, well, I own 10 shares of Newmont Mining. And this morning I got a letter from Newmont urging me as a shareholder to write the Secretary of the Interior, tell him off, tell him how outrageous his mining proposals are. Well, it's not exactly what the letter says, but that's the essence of what it says. Mary Gravelos asked me, she said, what's your advice? And I said, well, I have some advice for you and all the other Newmont shareholders. Why don't you write a letter to the board of directors of Newmont and say, I'm a shareholder of Newmont Mining, and I'm also an American citizen. And I heard President Clinton's call for all Americans to rise to the occasion and support a budget package that calls upon all of us, for the sake of America, to be reasonable and to make a few concessions about revenues and budget cuts. And I, as a shareholder of Newmont, would like the directors of the Newmont Mining Corporation to hear that message. They're not an American-owned corporation, but they can act in the American national interest. And they can put a figure on the table. And my challenge to Newmont is, rather than simply blindly opposing reform, write a letter to your shareholders and say as follows. We've offered to pay X percent as a fair beginning point in a negotiation. That's my idea of a reasonable response. Well, we've also staked out a reform agenda for the grazing of livestock on public lands. Now, as I transition to the grazing issue, I'll concede at the outset that grazing is a very different issue from mining. The impacts of mining are intensive and localized. In contrast, the implications of grazing affect every single acre of the public domain. The results of overgrazing are the invasion of cheatgrass and noxious weeds, erosion, riparian destruction, are well known and documented. But ranching is different from mining in many other ways. Most mining is carried out, as I've suggested, by heavily capitalized corporate enterprises managed from remote cities located a long way away from the American West. In contrast, most ranchers are individuals, they're families, raising kids and living on the land. And anyone who's familiar with Western ranching knows that it's a tough business. Nobody's getting rich out there. And the people who live on the land have dedicated a lot of sweat equity and tears and hardship to try and to make a go in the roller coaster economic climate that is American ranching. There's just not a lot of profit in it. Now, that means to me that the grazing issue is really about more the condition of the land than the size of the grazing fee. And I therefore share the view of reformers who believe that grazing fees and land stewardship should be linked together in an attempt to create direct incentives for restoring the public lands to good condition with a vigorous community of natural vegetation and wildlife. Now, in the past, the word incentive has been equated with rebates to ranchers for the construction of fences and stock tanks to increase the number of cattle on the land. It's not what I'm talking about, because generally, I don't think grazing subsidies should be given for that purpose. In most cases, the overall condition of the range isn't going to benefit from increased permit numbers. And in fact, in some cases, good stewardship will mean fewer animals on the land. In most cases, it will mean protection of riparian areas and improved seasonal rotation practices. And in every case, I believe it will require more public participation in the process of formulating range management plans. And what that means to me is that if incentives are to be given for better range conservation plans, we're going to have to work out a new process for reaching consensus on those plans. The old way of generating plans in a closed shop of BLM employees, the permit holder, a local advisory board stacked with local ranchers, is going to have to give away to something that's more open, participative, where environmentalists, public citizens, elected officials, all the stakeholders can be actively involved in planning the best use of that land. Now, I've not formulated any specific numbers for the grazing fees, and I'm not sure exactly how best to link concessions on fees to stewardship plans formulated with public participation out at the local level. And that's the reason that I've agreed, beginning this week, to hold public hearings in Bozeman, Montana, Grand Junction, Colorado, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Reno, Nevada, and Phoenix, Arizona. The use of public participation and discussion in an informal setting to try to find common ground and set goals is, I will concede, it's not an original idea with Bruce Babbitt. It's what President Clinton did when he went several weeks ago out to Portland, Oregon, and initiated the Forest Conference, thereby establishing a new model for making natural resource policy in the West. And it's a model that, whatever our differences, I intend to follow in the reform of grazing and every other resource issue in the West. Now, third and last, I'd like to illustrate the transition to market principles and market pricing in another important and often overlooked resource area in the West, and that is, of course, the most important Western issue, the lifeblood of all Western economic activity, water. For too long, the answer to every water issue in the West has been yet another federally subsidized water project, repayable at below interest rates by proceeds from heavily discounted water charges. And across time, as the West grows, the search for more water from ever more distant resources with greater and greater environmental destruction seems less and less relevant to the modern needs of the West, because there is an alternative. There's plenty of water developed and available in the West. If only we would allow market principles to replace heavy-handed, rigid, bureaucratic water allocations. If we price water at its true cost, a remarkable number of things happen. It's been proven time and time again. If we price water at its marginal replacement cost, what happens? Water consumption goes down. If city users are paying real unsubsidized water rates, they respond to market forces and have all over this country by reducing consumption. The same is increasingly true in the agriculture sector. It's a nice illustration of where the real water hole is in the American West. It's in economics, in conservation, in efficiency. Now, my task will be to see if we can guide and participate in this transition. In California, it's the Central Valley that will be the test ground for these principles, and that's because the Miller-Bradley bill passed last year mandates market principles and environmental values in the process of restructuring water use in that valley. Another example that I would share with you for illustrative purposes is the city of Las Vegas. Now, Las Vegas is a boom town. It's had the fastest and most dynamic growth curve of any Western city. And even with good conservation, which they have only recently tried, it's clear that they're going to need some additional water supply. But rather than seeking assistance to draw an additional entitlement from the Colorado River, which flows right by the city limits, the people of the Las Vegas Valley have developed a multi-billion-dollar project to go a third of the way across the state to drain federal lands of the groundwater that supports the riparian environment, the marshlands, the few remaining wet areas of the Great Basin, which in turn support the flyways, or the waterfowl flyways of the Pacific Coast. They've also cooked up a plan which they want to present to the United States Congress for a modest $1 billion to go to a remote tributary the Colorado River that has brackish water and build a desalting plant so they can pipe this water at federal expense to Las Vegas. And you may say, well, why don't they just use the water that's right next to the city? Well, the answer is because for 100 years, it's been gospel, sacred script in the West that you couldn't possibly devise some new legal framework procedures through water transfers, interstate marketing, these kinds of mechanisms to work out a rational way of taking the water that's at the water hole right next door. Well, I end with that example not to castigate the citizens of Las Vegas, but simply to illustrate that this tendency to think that the future is always going to be managed and developed exactly the way we did it 10 years ago leads to absurd results. And as evidence of my good faith in using this example, I am undertaking, together with the congressional delegation from Nevada, to see if we can't get into the structure of the interstate agreements in the Colorado River Basin and say, Las Vegas needs water, we're going to get it. We're going to get it in the market. We're going to get it without sort of ripping up vast acreages at untold cost across the West. Finally, I want to make a last point about the context of these proposals. None of these land and water use reforms, none of them, would be possible were it not for the focus that President Clinton has provided. He's continually focused on the central economic issue of our time. He's been unwavering in his commitments to fairness, rational investment policies, and steady reduction of the deficit, both by reducing expenditures and collecting the full value of federal resources. When he raised these reforms in his first budget address, he framed them as economic issues. And that statement is what put them on the map. We're going to keep them on the map, and we're going to pursue this until we get lasting reform. As we address these issues, I must tell you, we do so in the same context the administration has applied to all economic matters. Fairness will define our decisions. The national interest will have primacy over special or regional interests. And as we set out to create a new American land ethic, we're attempting to bring old and true economic values to a new and urgent cause, the imperative to live more lightly and more productively on the land. Our land. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. We have a number of questions to begin with on the Park Service. The first one is, when will you announce the new head of the National Park Service, and who will it be?
I can't tell you who the new head of the Park Service will be. That is a decision to be made by the President, and we've had some discussions about it. I suspect that we are quite close, perhaps within a week or two, to having a decision.
It was widely reported that the job of the National Park Service Director was offered to Robert Redford and Tom Brokaw. Why do you think the Park Service needs a celebrity director instead of a career park and resource professional?
The Park Service doesn't need a celebrity director. What it needs is a highly competent, strong, visionary director. Now, should that be from inside or outside? It can be from either. I mean, IBM, after decades of going to the inside, in its recent travails has gone conspicuously to the outside. The National Park Service is full of extraordinary and dedicated professionals, but it has problems from lack of leadership, lack of resources, and my commitment to those of you who care so deeply about the park system as I do is that I will give you a first-rate leader.
How do you plan to make up for the $500 million you lost in the stimulus package defeat? Will there be cuts in the park services or other current programs?
Well, the torpedoing of the stimulus package has especially unhappy results for the Department of the Interior, because we had really looked to that stimulus package as a way to make up for shortfalls in maintenance, construction, trails, reforestation, river work in both the national park system and the fish and wildlife refuges. The maintenance and upkeep and infrastructure of these public lands has been badly neglected. There's a multi-billion dollar backlog, and frankly, I really regret that we didn't have a vote on the stimulus package, because if we had had a vote on it, it would have passed, and it would have been enormously helpful.
Again, given the difficulty with the Senate, what are two or three examples of environmental measures you can enact administratively?
Environmental measures that I can enact administratively. The answer is that, with the exception of mining, all of them. I must tell you, the extraordinary thing about this department is that the lights have been out for the last 12 years. The Congress has passed year after year some quite impressive environmental laws. There's a huge number of them on the books, and most of them have never been enforced. They haven't even tried to implement them. There's a bit of a crusade in some quarters to say the Endangered Species Act is fatally flawed. It can't be made to work. It's a drag on the American economy. I don't know how they'd ever know, because for the last 12 years, nobody's tried to implement it. They spent all their time attacking the concept. By resisting and failing to enforce the law, creating some extraordinary human suffering. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. The Pacific Northwest is a great example. Because of the absolute obstinance of federal agencies and their refusal and failure to obey the law, what happened in the Pacific Northwest was that after years of frustration, a federal judge appointed by President Reagan finally said to the federal agencies, I'm going to rule this forest by judicial injunction because of your bad faith and unwillingness to obey the law. Well, obviously that's what the Forest Conference was about, was simply stepping up to that obligation. And everywhere I turn, we have opportunities to get out ahead of the problem and use the existing laws.
What is your top legislative priority?
Number one, pass the stimulus package. Number two, pass the Clinton budget. Number three, mining reform.
Okay. Won't charging mining, forest, and ranching companies a fair share cost the consumer more and make our products less competitive overseas?
No, I don't think so. Look, either believe in the American system or you don't. There have to be revenues. Now, the question is, are we going to get at this economic issue by charging you more money to make up for the failure of the mining companies to pay, or by saying that we're going to have an equitable allocation of the revenues that we all know have to be raised?
California farmers continue to complain, despite the recent rain, that the Bureau of Reclamation is holding water distribution to just 25% of previous levels. Do you have any comment on that?
No, I really don't, because I have not. The allocation of water is made under some very complex formulas based on weather forecasting, a variety of other factors in California, and I have not and won't intervene in the scientific decision-making. The good news in California is that it was a very wet winter. The reservoirs are filling, and it looks like we're headed back toward a more normal environment, and that's good news for everybody.
You've talked about the job of building dams for water reclamation being finished. Does this mean finished to the Bureau of Reclamation as well?
Well, some of you may have heard me in my earlier incarnation making some wild and rash remarks when I was younger and less knowledgeable of the world that we should simply abolish the Bureau of Reclamation. Well, I don't subscribe to that. The Bureau of Reclamation, you know, where you stand depends on where you sit, I guess. But in all seriousness, the Bureau is chock-a-block full of some really extraordinary scientists, engineers, and hydrology professionals. And my intent is to transition the Bureau away from being the world's largest construction company toward being the world's best water manager. That process is underway, and what I simply intend to do is kind of keep it going.
If your plan for a mining royalty couldn't pass muster with Western Democratic senators when it was part of the administration's budget bill, how do you think Western legislators will support a hefty royalty later on as part of mining law reform?
Well, I guess we're going to find out. The reason that it was taken out of the budget reconciliation process is because of the so-called Byrd Amendment, which says, quite understandably, you can put numbers in a budget bill, but you're not supposed to do substantive legislation. That's for the legislative process. Now, in my naivete and innocence, freshly arrived in town, I thought, this is great. The mining reform may be a couple hundred pages of legislation, but we'll just include it as a footnote in the budget process. And I think that the objections, that it ought to be heard on the merits without taking the shortcut through the reconciliation bill, are reasonable. And the president made that decision with my support. Now, as to the issue of Western votes, my feeling is that the citizens of my state, Arizona, and a lot of other Western states support mining reform because they understand what the president is asking of all of us. And they're not about to say, that's all of us except mining companies. The problem is that the mining company PACs and special interest groups and lawyers have got an awful lot of influence. But if you take an opinion poll in Arizona, you're going to wonder, I think, why it is this mythology that Westerners are opposed to reform. They're not. Now, the Congress is another matter.
Will you try to levy the new mining fees retroactively on mining companies that already hold patents or claims on federal lands? Would this be possible legally or politically?
Well, I've thought about that. It does sound a little punitive, doesn't it? No, I don't think that's a serious suggestion. It's been surfaced in some of my testimony as an alternative, but no, I don't support that. I mean, I think you've got to either say, we're going to have a royalty-based system for federal lands or a general severance tax on all miners, and I don't think that's in the cards.
How much should ranchers pay to graze cattle on public land, and what should be done to make sure that grazing isn't environmentally destructive?
Come and see me in Bozeman, Grand Junction, Denver, Albuquerque, Reno, and Phoenix.
Do you believe the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act needs to be addressed with new legislation to avoid some of the confusion that has occurred in Arizona over the number and types of games that will be allowed?
I don't know. There is a fair amount of controversy over the compact process in the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. It's tended to obscure the fact that in many states, the compact process is working quite well, and in many, many states, Indian tribes, which are located in remote areas, which have not had much chance for economic development, and which have not gotten adequate attention in the context of the federal budget, have really gotten a new lease on jobs and on-reservation economic development. It's been, for the most part, very successful. Now, what I intend to do, rather than getting into a great rhetorical debate on Capitol Hill, is see if we can walk right into the middle of the areas where we're having difficulties, and there are some, but certainly a small minority of the cases, and see if we can work out a compromise. So those of you who are familiar with the Arizona case, I think will appreciate that we've made a lot of progress. It's to say it's been controversial out there is an understatement, but I think we're headed toward a compromise, and I think that's my job.
Do you think there is any way to solve the Navajo-Hopi dispute in the joint use area that can bring real justice to both groups?
It will take the wisdom of Solomon and the patience of Job to figure that out. Now, I hasten to add that I have disqualified myself completely from that issue, not because of its complexity, but because I was once the general counsel for the Navajo tribe, because I have litigated a number of Indian land claims, represented a number of the competing land and water users in that area, taken positions as governor. My family owns a ranch that's nearby, and I finally said on coming to Washington, this one I will pass elsewhere.
What is the timing of the Endangered Species Act reauthorization? And what do you mean by ecosystem protection versus critical habitat?
The debate about the Endangered Species Act, as I've already suggested, is in fact underway, and it seems to me quite likely that either this year or next, the Congress will begin to get into this issue. My own sense is that, as I've suggested, the real job is to explore the use of the powers that are already contained in the Endangered Species Act. Now, what that means to me is you don't wait and stonewall and drag your feet to the 11th hour when there's a crisis, a species is dwindling toward extinction, it's been crowded into the last small corner of habitat which is desperately needed for mining or oil or a shopping center, and you have a full-blown crisis. The way to make this act work is to get good science out there looking at the entire ecosystem, not just at one species, but at all of the species, and have the ability to see the problem coming before the 11th hour. Well, you still have time to make management changes, to enter into land use arrangements that prevent it. Now, that's the reason for all the emphasis on the gnatcatcher habitat in California, where we have used a virtually unknown provision of the act to delegate some of this power to the state of California under its laws, where they have the land use planning capability to try to work out these conflicts. It's the reason that we brought the Georgia Pacific Corporation up last week to announce a consensual plan for the administration of some 6 million acres of their land, which is habitat to the red-cockaded woodpecker. That corporation has worked out a logical and obvious plan. They train their loggers, they use a few biologists, they find the critical nesting sites and work their way around them. They don't have to put vast areas off limits. All they have to do is use sensitive logging practices. And as we signed that agreement, I thought, what would have happened in the Pacific Northwest if we had been doing this in Washington and Oregon 10 years ago?
You've talked about reforming grazing fees, mining laws, and water resource management, but I don't believe you've mentioned so-called below-cost timber sales. How do you propose reforming these sales?
End below-cost timber sales.
Does the administration have any plans to provide assurances that smaller timber operators will have access to the reduced amount of federal timber that could result if reforms in timber sales are made?
Well, all of these issues are in play right now in this process of developing a timber plan in the Pacific Northwest. And I guess I'd rather not speculate about the exact contents of that plan. It will be in the president's hands before the end of May, and he has indicated quite clearly his desire to get a forest plan in motion by or shortly after the 1st of June.
Okay. What are your priority conservation issues for Alaska and why?
My priority conservation issues for Alaska. Number one is to keep my promise to Senator Stevens and Murkowski and Congressman Young that I'm going to spend 3 weeks in Alaska this summer. I mean, it's really going to be tough. I think probably during the month of August. I think that whatever the risk, I'm going to find some way to take my family along, probably run a river or two. And seriously, I'm going to spend as much time as I can getting deeply familiar with the Alaska issues. They are they're very important. There's an entirely distinct set of Native American issues in Alaska. As the Anchorage newspaper is fond of pointing out in its editorials, I am in fact the czar of Alaska, as they put it, because of the extraordinary federal land base in Alaska. For the people in Alaska, I just want to say I'm looking forward to it.
If royalties are the answer, why are we as a nation importing increasing amounts of petroleum while much of our domestic industry sits idle?
Well, the plain fact is that we do import about half of our oil supply. I've never understood the logic of the people behind that question who seem to be saying that we ought to drain America first. You know, we have an absolute obligation to extract every drop now so that our national security posture will be even worse. I mean, imports are a part of a world economy, and they're part of a proper part of our energy picture.
Bureau of Indian Affairs schools face severe budget shortfalls, and some face closure because of the stimulus failure. How will you address this problem?
We're going to keep the Indian schools open. It's a, well, we're really getting down into the line items here. The problem is that the Indian finance formula is just that, a per capita formula, and the enrollment figures have outstripped the budget projections. But yeah, sure, look, the stimulus bill would help us fix the problem, but in any event, this is one where we will find the money.
Which federal agencies have jurisdictions that require your department to have close interactions with to achieve your goals, and what efforts are you taking to increase cooperation with these agencies?
State, Defense, Treasury, CIA. All of them in some way. It's quite striking. The environment is no longer, and for that matter, the Administration of Natural Resources is no longer a narrow categorical kind of issue. Just to give you a few examples, the Forest Service is in the Department of Agriculture. The administration of the Endangered Species Act is in the Department of Commerce. The standard setting for clean water is at the Environmental Protection Agency. My jurisdiction, under international treaties relating to tigers, rhinos, elephants, parrots, the endangered species population of the world, feeds directly into the State Department. The Defense Department is the third largest landowner in the United States, right behind BLM and the Forest Service. And their environmental responsibilities for that land base are one of the great important facts of environmental protection that is hardly ever mentioned. So the answer is all of the above. The Army runs the Corps of Engineers. We don't need to underline the importance of that.
Before asking the final question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation from the National Press Club for speaking here today. and a copy of The North American Indians and Early Photographs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Final question. You talked about market reforms, land use reforms. How much would you charge to an American citizen to buy a tree in an old growth forest so that it would not be cut?
It's an interesting question, what this is I think a. I think I should have just checked out ahead of this last question. this is really, I think, part of it, of a little theory which says, if the American people want to save the environment, make them pay for every tree and every square acre of land that we already own. And I must say, it's a little odd for me to read these editorials in the Wall Street Journal, are always saying, well, let the environmentalists bid with the loggers for the timber on public lands. And I'm thinking, hey, wait a minute, that's ours. That's ours. And I think we ought to underline the fact, it's really kind of sagebrush rebellion number three. If their idea of market principles is auctioning off the public domain, privatizing Grand Canyon National Park, having another sagebrush rebellion, the answer is include me out. It's not going to happen on my watch. Thank you.